Hi, and welcome to the AA Grapevine. I'm your volunteer reader, Shelley Miller. Today, I will be reading from the July 2025 issue of the AA Grapevine. This is part 2 of 3 for the month. In this show, we're going to read some stories about the seventh step, the seventh tradition, home groups, and newcomers. Let's get started. Our first story is about Step 7, Humbly Asked Him to Remove Our Shortcomings, and it's entitled Digging the Steps, submitted by Anonymous in Mason City, Iowa. Determined to do his seventh step, a member grabs his boots, bundles up, and gives it his all. I see our seventh step, in which we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings, as an opportunity for me to change my personality for the better. The short paragraph in Into Action in our big book is pretty simple. It asks us to say a prayer, known as the seven-step prayer. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. This sounded easy and just what I was looking for, a quick fix. Only trouble was, it didn't work. I went out to a special place near a trout stream and said the prayer and felt better momentarily, but found no lasting effect. Maybe I missed something. Maybe I was not entirely ready. So I went back to step 6. I knew I needed to get rid of a lot of my defects of character, such as my selfishness and anger, because I still used anger on occasion as a tool to keep people away or to get my own way. My biggest fear around this step was that if all my defects and shortcomings were gone, what would be left? My personality did not have a lot of good characteristics, at least not that I was using with any frequency. I did not want the seventh step to leave me empty and void. I pondered and meditated on this, and then I went back to the same trout stream and tried again. I prayed the seven-step prayer, and I still did not feel cured or purified. Maybe I didn't need help. I was in the middle of a fifth step with a man named Roger, so I decided to seek his guidance on this perplexing issue. He kept things simple, but maybe it was not as easy as I wanted to believe. He suggested that God would remove the bad stuff, the defects and shortcomings, but it would be my responsibility to replace them with their opposites, the good, positive qualities. He then suggested that to get rid of my selfishness, I should practice doing something for others with no thought of reward or what was in it for me. This really was a new concept, but it also was simple and sounded like it could be easy. I could perform a random act of kindness. I could practice patience in the express line at the grocery store, offer the checkout person a smile, a friendly greeting, and not count the number of items in the other customers' baskets. I could apply this attitude while waiting in line for my afternoon coffee during my short 10-minute break. I could even return money when given the wrong change to practice honesty. I could try to find the owner of cash found in the street instead of just putting it in my pocket. And that's what I did. Strange as it seemed then, these simple acts soon became routine with practice. At that time, an elderly woman, probably near my grandmother's age, was living next door to me. When it snowed, I got up a few minutes earlier to shovel her walk along with my own. It was still dark and nobody watched me, so my ego was not at play, and I did not seek any financial reward for my labors. It seemed to snow more that first winter, so it gave me ample opportunities to practice not being selfish. The woman also had a gate on her fence with a rotten wood post that was easy to fix in the spring. I also worked on some simple things like a broken clothesline pole and a tree that got hit by lightning. More opportunities to help. I shoveled for the chance to change, to grow in a positive direction, and to start feeling better about myself. Actually, after a while, I did get a heartfelt thanks and freshly baked cookies, delicious and rewarding in themselves, from my neighbor. It didn't take my next door neighbor too long to figure out who was shoveling her walk. When she finally moved away to a retirement community, I was sad to see her leave the neighborhood. She left without knowing just how much she had helped me grow up and become a better member of society. And now a story about the seventh tradition, which states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. This story is entitled OMG We're Broke, and it was submitted by Clyde M. of Dallas, Texas. He had just gotten elected to be his group's new treasurer when the terrible news came in. No money. How would they ever pay the rent? After my first 90 days sober, members of my home group suggested it was time for me to get active. I disagreed, but my sponsor thought it was a great idea. Soon after, the position of group treasurer just happened to open up, and my sponsor nominated me for the position. Before I knew what had happened, the group unanimously elected me to the job. Unanimous! Wow! I felt so pleased. However, it didn't take long for my ego to deflate. First, I was the sole candidate, and second, my home group was not in great financial shape. Though we regularly practiced the seventh tradition of passing the basket, our meeting the last few months had not yielded even close to enough money to meet all the group's expenses. Our rent was due the next week, and that meant we would be in arrears. Our landlord had no sympathy, understanding, or interest in the AA program. If we didn't collect enough to pay the current rent, the unpaid balance would double what we needed the following month. Alarmed over the encroaching disaster, I called our group chairperson and advised him that we were in trouble. He scheduled a group conscious meeting for the next Saturday to address the shortage and discuss solutions. When Saturday arrived, there was a knot in my stomach. I couldn't imagine how the group would survive. Even worse, it would all be happening on my watch. I would be known as the member in charge when our group sank into a sea of red ink. 11 group members showed up for the group conscious meeting. 11 members were better than none, but I had expected many more. Didn't my fellow sober alcoholics realize this was a major disaster? The group chairman opened the meeting, and the first order of business was the treasurer's report. I nervously read the miserable figures aloud, and when I finished, there was an uncomfortable silence in the room. After what seemed like a long time, a senior member made a suggestion. "Why don't we pass the basket right now and bring our deficit up to date?" he proposed. "We can start looking at solutions once we better understand where we stand." Everyone agreed, and with only 11 people, the basket didn't take but 3 minutes to go around and be returned to me. I began counting. It took less than 3 minutes, and there were 9 $20 bills, 2 personal checks, each for $100. My voice wavered as I read aloud the new treasury bottom line. We now had enough to pay the rent and had half of the next month's expenses. The old-timer who had suggested passing the basket looked around and asked, "Anything else?" Everyone shook their heads. "No." "Okay," he said. "Let's close with the Lord's Prayer." Our group conscience meeting lasted less than 10 minutes. That's all it took for 11 group members to save us from disaster. My head was spinning. I needed to talk with my sponsor. I spoke to him rapidly, disjointedly. I wasn't sure how to explain the sudden deliverance from bankruptcy I had just witnessed. My sponsor spelled out the meaning of the seventh tradition. He explained 2 reasons why AA groups must be self-supporting. Without it, our ultimate authority, a loving God, would be replaced by our new financial partner's board of directors, who would enthusiastically express their authority in our group conscience. Second, our primary purpose would be changed. The group's new primary purpose would be making a profit for our financier. Carrying the AA message to alcoholics who are suffering would no longer matter. The miracle of AA would be a distant memory, and we alcoholics would be facing our disease alone. Now I understood why the members took immediate action on our expense shortfall, out of their own pockets without a second thought. Many years later, I still get chills when I think of that day and what it meant. My time as a group treasurer brought about a humble appreciation of our responsibility declaration read at the beginning of our meetings that says, "I am responsible. When anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible." Our next story is about the home group, and it's entitled, "Come and Get It." and it was submitted by MS in St. Louis, Missouri. These members in St. Louis may be serious about their program, but they sure know how to have a good time. I've heard it said that AA is full of characters. That's certainly true, and my home group is blessed with more than its share. We have lots of crusty yet serene long-timers, a bunch of boisterous youngsters on fire with passion for the solution, and plenty of newer folks to keep the rest of us busy and focused on the basics. We never try to take ourselves too seriously, and we have some fun while we stay sober and help one another. I'm a devoted member of Group 344. There is a solution. A mixed closed meeting that gathers on Saturday mornings in West St. Louis County, Missouri. We're a three legacy group. We study the steps and traditions and create an atmosphere where service is a priority. When we hold our monthly group conscious meeting, most of our home group members attend. All our service positions get filled. We even create new positions to try and get more members involved. We have fellowship for about an hour before our meeting starts. People sign up to bring healthy and unhealthy snacks each week to enjoy before our meetings begins. There's an old AA saying that if you feed them, they will come. A whole lot of folks get there early to eat and socialize. During announcements, everyone is invited to go out for lunch for more fellowship after the meeting. I guess we really like to talk and eat. We have two greeters posted at the door to welcome everyone, as well as newcomer ambassadors whose job it is to catch the brand new folks before they can bolt after the meeting. We hold a yearly chili cook-off with AA speakers and a hotly contested chili competition with trophies and prizes for the winners. It's an open meeting that day, which we announce to the regional recovery community. Everyone is welcome to attend, and we get a good crowd. Every Monday night, we take a meeting into a local treatment center, which gives us the opportunity to connect with brand new people who need sponsors and directions on where to find AA. We encourage them to come join us on Saturday mornings after they are released. Some actually come. Being actively engaged in a home group is one of the most important things I can do to enhance and safeguard my sobriety. I believe that every human being has a basic need to belong, to be part of something good, to contribute, to keep and make commitments, and to know the joy of encouraging and helping others. My home group provides all that goodness. Honestly, I don't necessarily like every one of my home group members. I find some of them irritating at times. I'll bet I irritate some of them, or most of them too. But I absolutely love each of them in a special way. We are a family made up of characters and many different personalities. We have disagreements at times, but for the most part, we are united in our common cause of staying sober and carrying the message as best we can. This next story is also on the topic of home group, and it's entitled Friends for Life, and it was submitted by Bill K. of Tacoma, Washington. Struggling to accept the changes that come with age, a member finds meetings and fellowship a saving grace. The day finally came when my sponsor, Mark, became limited to his bed. He's 83 now, and his physical decline after many proud years of employment and quiet service to others was hard for me to witness. When the doctor suggested that he no longer drive, he gave his car away and I drove him to AA meetings. Next, he couldn't climb the stairs. Then he didn't have the energy to get out of bed. I resisted accepting the obvious, that our shared time at AA meetings was over. What could I do? I was afraid of what would be next. When that day came, I reluctantly went to our Thursday noon meeting alone. Despite my heavy heart, I had an extraordinary experience at the meeting that placed me exactly within the spiritual continuity of male elders spanning four generations. Our common links that day, we shared values and deep friendship. Prior to formal introductions, my seatmate at the meeting, apologizing for his cane, introduced himself as Jim. He and I then quickly launched into our short histories of our memberships in AA. Soon we realized that we had met years before. We also discovered we each had been closely bonded to a man named Herb, who died many years before Jim and I first met. We have both attended his funeral. Due to illness, distance, lack of mobility, and other limitations of aging, Jim and I had not connected since. Our mutual bond, memories, and experiences with Herb in and out of AA brought on waves of feelings in me. I could see tears in Jim's eyes as we caught up with each other. A sense of isolation that had crept into my aging that day began to melt. Now, hours later, I remain emotionally lifted up. I am experiencing the support of a long line of men, including my sponsor, committed to living life on life's terms and growing into accepting dying in its own time and terms. 2 days later, I was informed there was still space in the men's retreat I had long wanted to make. The miracles of AA, fellowship, and God continue to accomplish things for me that I cannot do for myself. Our next story is from the newcomer section, and it's titled Taking Flight, submitted by AC from Issaquah, Washington. Feeling defeated, a newcomer was heading straight for a beer. Luckily, a little feathered friend got in his way. I got sober in February of 2001. It wasn't easy in the beginning. I walked around under a dark cloud for the first 2 years of sobriety, even though I thought I had done everything I was told to do in AA. I went to meetings, talked to my sponsors, and sought outside help, but the dark cloud just wouldn't leave. I was unable to speak in meetings, I didn't reach out to help others, and I was not ready or willing to do my fourth step. I was stuck in a deep depression, which eventually led me to thoughts of relapse and even suicide. My sponsor kept suggesting that I help somebody else. He said helping others was the key to sobriety, but I just didn't have the willingness to do that. And the dark clouds kept swiftly taking over. As it turns out, my sponsor was right. Only my turnaround didn't happen the way I expected. One day, feeling empty and defeated by the itty-bitty you-know-what committee in my head, I left my house to walk to the store for a beer. I didn't care what kind of beer. I just wanted relief. I wanted it quick. On my way, I saw two crows dive-bombing people on the street. Something in my head said to look down. On the grass, I saw a tiny black figure, not much larger than a lump of coal. For some reason, I decided to take a quick detour from my mission to the store to investigate. There in the grass was a newborn crow that had fallen from a nest about 40 feet overhead. I placed the tiny featherless bird in my hand, and all of a sudden I realized I was at a crossroads too. My options were to continue on my way to get that beer or return home to take care for this helpless creature. I made my choice. Over the next 2 months, as I cared for my new little friend, the tiniest sliver of light started to gradually peek through the dark clouds. I named my friend Odin. I learned how to care for him, what to feed him, and how to bring him comfort. During that time, I spoke with my sponsor often and met with my therapist. As I tended to Odin, I found myself more open to suggestions and willing to take action. I kept on a regular schedule of AA meetings and started to talk more and reach out to others. When I came home from meetings, Odin would fly down the hall to greet me. He would jump up on my shoulder and nibble on my ear. It felt amazing that he needed me as much as I needed him. Odin would eventually join me outside, taking practice flights around the yard and returning to the safety of my hand. Day by day, he grew stronger, until one day Odin took flight, never to return. I experienced a feeling I never had before, though in some ways it felt familiar. I was sad to see my feathered friend leave, but I was also warmed and nourished in my heart that I'd been there to help. It was my first real spiritual experience. 2 weeks later, the dark clouds rolled back into my life, and once again I felt the desire to drink and drug. I was outside in a state of despair when suddenly a small, dark figure appeared. It was Odin. He had a deep wound on his foot, so I bandaged him up, took him into my home to nurse him back to health. Over the next several days, while tending to my friend, I finished my fourth and fifth steps. There was some magic in being out of my head and into service for Odin, which helped me focus on the next steps of my recovery. I realized once again that I needed that crow as much as he needed me. When his wound was completely healed, Odin flew off for the final time. There were many occasions in the months to follow when crows would come visit on my porch, which always made me smile. As the weeks and months went by, I found myself gazing towards the sky whenever I felt dark clouds returning. The sight of a crow overhead gave me a sense of connection to a power greater than myself and a reminder of the importance of helping others. These days, I no longer look toward an outer resource for peace or serenity. I have an inner resource that I can always tap into. I can close my eyes today and see a crow, and it reminds me why I'm here on this journey, to help someone else. And our next story is entitled, Nothing in Moderation, by Charles M. in Freehold, New Jersey. In everything, including sobriety, thankfully, he knows no moderation. Long before I became addicted to alcohol, I used other mood-altering substances to excess. I started with sugar. In my preteens, I engaged in an elaborate ritual consuming a certain caramel chocolate candy bar while watching TV. When I was at the movies or on a long car ride, I often bought large bags of other types of chocolate. I didn't mean to eat the whole bag, I just wanted one more, until the bag was empty. When confronted with a platter of fresh baked chocolate chip cookies, I didn't intend to eat all 27. I just wanted to eat one more, which I did until the platter was empty. I chewed gum the same way. I'd chew the first stick furiously until the flavor gave out, then pop in a fresh stick. When the flavor again subsided, I'd replace the wad with another fresh stick until the pack was completely empty. When I started drinking alcohol at age 13, I treated a six-pack of beer or a half pint of rye the same as a bag of candy. Just one more can or one more swig until the supply was gone. Later, the six-pack became a 12-pack and the half pint became a pint. My favorite drink was the next one. The same goes for cigarettes. I smoked 2 packs a day by the time I was in high school. They say you can judge a man's or woman's character by his or her heroes. My idol in my teens was a classmate named Dave, who, it was reputed, could drink a case of beer and still not be drunk. Vowing to become like Dave, I went into training just as an athlete would prepare for the Olympics. It took many years of practice, but eventually I could put away a case of beer and not be drunk, or so I thought. A sober observer might have thought otherwise. Incidentally, Dave died of complications from alcoholism. The trouble was, as my capacity for beer increased, it took too long to feel good. I really preferred to drink stronger, hard liquor. At age 25, I was sitting in the NCO club in an overseas Air Force base, about to ship back to the States for discharge. I'd already been relieved of duty, so naturally I spent my final days and evenings drinking at the club. One particular day, I was having a quadruple 7-to-1 ratio Manhattans, which the bartender served to me in a beer stein, the largest glass in the house. I was seated at the table with a group of guys who had just shipped in. One of them looked down at my stein and remarked, "Hey man, your beer's flat." With a look of disdain, I informed him that it wasn't beer, it was a Manhattan. His eyes filled with wonder and admiration as he exclaimed, "Wow, man, you drink Manhattans like everyone else drinks beer." At last, I received the recognition I so richly deserved. If only my Olympian capacity for alcohol could have lasted forever. Unfortunately, I began to lose it in my 30s. I could still drink a case of beer or a fifth, but it took a few naps to finish the job. Naps during my drinking became a problem. Most bartenders wouldn't tolerate it. I would go into a bar at 10 in the morning and after a good night's sleep, start drinking draft beers. The next thing I know, the bartender was shaking me, telling me I couldn't sleep there. I hated having to move from bar to bar to stay awake when I wasn't even drunk, or so I thought. Once in a while, I'd find a special bar where they didn't seem to mind my taking a catnap now and then. In the service, we had an expression called coming up reaching. We'd be sitting around someone's room in the barracks, each with his own bottle and glass. One of the gang would drift off for an hour or so, then he would begin to stir, and even before his eyes opened, his hand would instinctively reach out, grasp the glass, bring it to his lips. Coming up reaching was a great way to prolong a drinking bout. Of course, none of us were alcoholics, just heavy hitters. Civilian life was different. It grew harder and harder to find people who liked to drink like I did. at least respectable ones like me. In the service, we had a tradition of going on 24-hour drinking marathons when we finished our last midnight shift and went on break. But after I got out of the Air Force and took a temporary job in an aircraft factory on the third shift, I couldn't find any coworkers who wanted to drink shots and beers at 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning. To get that kind of action, I'd had to take the train 65 miles into New York City. I'd work my way down 3rd Avenue, Midtown to Greenwich Village, having one or two drinks at every bar along the way until I found a place with instant drinking buddies that suited my style. But that was then and this is now. I finally hit rock bottom after 26 years of drinking and came into AA. Thankfully, the rooms were full of people with whom I could have gladly drunk if we ever run across each other. Now I have 1.5 million friends I just haven't met yet. When we do meet, the camaraderie is often instantaneous. When I describe my all-or-nothing personality at a speaker discussion meeting, heads nod in empathy all over the room. It shouldn't surprise anyone that my attendance at AA meetings is as excessive as was my consumption of sweets, nicotine, and caffeine. As a late-onset diabetic, I'm off all those substances now. 90 meetings in 90 days has become over 17,000 in 17,000. I still can't get enough meetings. If I miss one on Monday, I go to 2 on Tuesday. Actually, more than 17,000 AA meetings hasn't hurt me one bit. I think I'll hit one tonight. And that's all the time we have for the AA Grapevine today. You've been listening to the July 2025 AA Grapevine. This is part 2 of 3 for this month. Thank you for listening. My name is Shelley Miller, and I've been your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.